Have, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have six cases on our calendar today, three of which are oral and three are non-oral. First case on our calendar is State of Minnesota versus Roosevelt Michael. Did I pronounce Helen's name correctly? Council will each have 15 minutes for your argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you could please identify yourself and the party you represent when you start your argument, we would appreciate that for the recording. And the podium is adjustable if need be. Please feel free to adjust the podium, and you'll see there's a clock available to monitor your time as well. So you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Lydia Villalba-Lijo, and I represent Mr. Roosevelt Michael, the appellant in this case. Mr. Michael is asking this court to reverse his convictions based on violations of his right to a speedy trial and based on a violation of his right to a speedy trial under the UMDDA. I'll address the speedy trial issue first. Mr. Michael and the state agree that more than 60 days passed from the date of his speedy trial demand to his trial, and that this court should review the remaining Barker factors. The state has also acknowledged that three of the four Barker factors favor Mr. Michael: the length of the delay, the reasons for the delay, and Mr. Michael's strong and insistent demand for a speedy trial. The only Barker factor that's in dispute here is whether Mr. Michael was prejudiced by the delay. And indeed, he was. The delay prejudiced Mr. Michael's defense, which is the most serious type of prejudice that can occur. During the delay, a material witness in Mr. Michael's case was released from incarceration, which would hamper Mr. Michael's access and access to that material witness and the availability of the witness.
Why?
Yes, sir.
Well, there is not all that much information available on the record, Your Honor, but it is clear that the witness was a material witness and is referred to in the complaint. The witness was no longer incarcerated. There's no indication of where.
Well, is there any indication on the record that the witness was no longer accessible and available for trial?
Well, because there's no evidence in the record that anyone knew where the witness was.
Well, isn't the burden on your at this point on your client to show prejudice, to show that there was an effort made to find the witness, that the witness was couldn't be located or some other way?
Well,
rendered unavailable?
Under State versus Griffin, Mr. Michael is not required to show actual prejudice. And under Windisch, the Supreme Court has said that likely harm to the defendant's case is sufficient.
What is the
but
likely
wouldn't
harm?
It be...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
The likely harm, Your Honor, would be that this was a material witness to the offense, and so presumably the testimony of that witness would be necessary in the case. That witness was no longer available in the sense that the witness, this offense occurred, maybe I should back up just a little bit. If you read the complaint, the offense allegedly occurred or originated during incarceration. So the witness had been released from incarceration. There's no information in the record that discloses whether that witness, the whereabouts of that witness. Moreover, we
but
also have a long passage of time. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Is there any evidence showing that, I'm sorry, maybe I don't want to misstate what you just said, but is there any evidence showing that that your client has tried to identify where that witness is? And I mean, is there any evidence showing that that witness couldn't be found and couldn't be subpoenaed?
There's no evidence of that However, it's not under the case law. The defendant, so Mr. Michael, did not have to prove the actual unavailability of that witness.
But you just argued that the witness is no longer available, I think, is what you said.
Yes, Your Honor. So the witness had been released from incarceration. No information in the record about the whereabouts of that witness. The standard is not that Mr. Michael
had to prove. How does that fall? How does the lack of evidence fall? Who is favored by the lack of evidence? The proponent of the speedy trial right, the asserter of the speedy trial right, or the state?
Your Honor, frankly, it probably depends on how the case plays out. Now, in this,
Doesn't it depend on who has the burden?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Doesn't it depend on who has the burden?
Well, here, in this case, when we're talking about the speedy trial, the burden on Mr. Michael was to prove likely harm. And by not having this witness, and that's under Windisch, so that not having a witness readily available, the whereabouts of that witness not known, the nature of the witness's testimony was material to the case.
How does that prove likely harm when it, I think the district court said it was speculative as to whether or not, you know, the claim that this witness was no longer available was speculative. Why was the district court wrong in that regard?
The district court stated that the harm was speculative, but the record is clear that the witness was no longer incarcerated. Defense counsel stated that clearly and also stated in the memo to the district court that the defense case was crippled by the lack of witness and the delay in the case. Now, clearly, the long delay here also would impair memories, potentially impact testimony about the offense.
Are there any other, aside from this witness being released from jail, in your claims about it's possible that there was memory, you know, there could be memory loss, any other, are you claiming any other evidence of prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. Another form of prejudice that's recognized is the frustration, anxiety, and stress that's experienced by the defendant. And it is very clear in the transcript of the motion hearing in this case. It's the November 5th, 2018 transcript that Mr. Michael was indeed experiencing anxiety and was experiencing stress as a result of these proceedings. His statements, his very candid statements.
While he was incarcerated on the domestic assault case, or how much time was there in between him being released from prison after the reversal of the domestic assault case and the complaint being filed? Is that in the record? It may not be in the record.
Okay, so I'm not sure, I do not recall the record stating when he was released from prison. Of course, he remained incarcerated. So after the domestic assault case was reversed and remanded by this court, my understanding is that he remained incarcerated, and he remained incarcerated throughout these proceedings.
Okay.
But just to sort of finish up on the anxiety and the stress, and it's connected to the reversal of the domestic assault, Mr. Michael very candidly told the court that he was having a very difficult time understanding how it could be that he could have the domestic assault conviction reversed and remanded and yet end up with additional charges now against him, charges that had been dismissed 11 months earlier, which actually sort of brings us to the next point.
Charges were dismissed without prejudice, correct?
Those charges were dismissed by the prosecutor in the interest of justice. And that's according to the document that was submitted by the prosecutor. And this actually is a good point to transition into another important aspect of the case, because we really cannot talk about Mr. Michael's speedy trial arguments without talking about the state's legal maneuvering in this case. Now, the record in this case reflects, or at a minimum strongly suggests, that the state was using the Danko violations as leverage for the domestic assault case. And that domestic assault case resulted initially in a conviction, but was later reversed by this court. Now, the state dismissed the Danko case after obtaining the domestic assault conviction and a 60-month sentence. But the dismissal also occurred after more than 60 days had passed from Mr. Michael's speedy trial demand in August of 2017, and also occurred after Mr. Michael had requested a speedy disposition of the Danko violation charges, so after he had submitted the UMDDA request. So it's reasonable to conclude that in addition to the state dismissing the Danko violations because it had obtained a conviction in a separate case, it also, at least in part, dismissed the Danko violations because it wanted to avoid the speedy trial timeline and also the UMDDA timeline. But that's not all.
Well, counsel, let's step back a second, though.
Yes, Your Honor.
Here, correct me if I'm wrong, but your client was sentenced on a separate charge in October 2017, a separate but related charge in October of 2017, and then in November of 2017, about a week after the UMDDA request, the Danko charges were dismissed. So why isn't that more reflective of a decision to conserve prosecutorial resources, given that your client was already sentenced to prison for a significant period of time? It seems logical for the state to decide that it really just wasn't worth pursuing the Danko charges at that time, given the conviction in the other case. What evidence is there that this was done, in bad faith or as a legal maneuver, as you're suggesting? I mean, this case seems really distinguishable from the Casper case that you cite.
Well, the reason that it was not solely an effort to preserve prosecutorial resources is because at that point, it doesn't reflect the entire arc of the case. Now, because it's also important to look at what happened after the dismissal. So after that domestic assault conviction was reversed,
but
the state
after the dismissal of, after the appeal you're talking about now.
Yes, so after
in terms of looking at the time frame, mm-hmm. and the delay and whether tolling should occur between the dismissal and the recharge, the dismissal of the Danko charges and the recharge, the appeal doesn't really come into play, does it?
Well, it all comes into play because we are talking about the arc of the case.
The appeal of the other case I'm talking about.
Well, the appeal of the case comes into play a little bit later after the dismissal of the Danko violations, which is what this case is.
Right.
And it comes into play because the state attempts to negotiate with Mr. Michael and makes at least one plea offer, and there's another plea offer that's referred to and discussed by the prosecutor in the November 5th, 2018 transcript.
But how does that relate to the dismissal of the Danko charges, which is really of concern here?
It relates in this way, Your Honor. First of all, okay, it relates in at least two ways. So the dismissal didn't just happen out of the blue. It's not just about preserving prosecutorial resources. Mr. Michael had asserted his right to a speedy trial early and often, several times by the time the state dismissed. So that's one. Two, although he had no obligation to bring himself to trial on the Danko violations, he also filed the UMDDA. So he made his desire to resolve those charges very clear. So that is at the point where we reach the dismissal. Now, after the dismissal, there is still conduct that is of concern and that's relevant. And that conduct is that the state attempted to resolve the domestic assault, this separate domestic assault charge. It made an offer, at one or two offers at least, to Mr. Michael to resolve the domestic assault case by promising or offering not to recharge on the Danko violations. So again, when you look at the arc of the case, you can't just stop at the point of dismissal because the case continued forward. And when you look at the entire arc of the case, you can see that the state was using the Danko violations as leverage with the domestic assault. And even though they dismissed the Danko violations 11 months earlier, when that domestic assault came back, now the state is very interested again in the Danko violations and attempting to use it to resolve the domestic assault. And as noted in the brief, ironically, the state ended up dismissing the domestic assault charge on the same day that Mr. Michael went to trial on the Danko violations. I see that I'm out of time, unfortunately. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. This court should affirm appellant's convictions because the state did not endeavor to create deliberate delays to hamper the defense, and although the length of the delay in this case triggers further analysis, fundamentally, appellant was in no way prejudiced by the delay. Now, the state agrees with appellant that this case does come down to prejudice. And it's the state's position that the appellant is unable to show prejudice at this juncture. The fact that a witness was released from jail does not mean that that witness is unavailable. There's no guarantee that a witness will remain in custody when a case is pending. The record doesn't show that that particular witness would have still been incarcerated had the case gone to trial in November of 2017. And there's simply no showing that any efforts were made to find that individual, that those efforts failed. As the district court at that hearing when this was litigated, the judge stated that there was no reason to believe that the defense could not find that person.
How conclusively must prejudice be proved before it can be relied upon as prejudice in the analysis?
Well, I think that the fact that case law repeatedly states that it can't be speculative, that we need something a little firmer than what we have here. I think that the fact that it needs to be likely prejudice, then I think that what we would need to see in a case like this is when the district court said, there's no reason to believe you can't find that person. If then on the record defense counsel stated, we don't have an address, my investigators tried, or we sent out the subpoena and it came back, we've been attempting to serve this individual and they've evaded service. You know, anything along those lines might be enough to show that the case was in a significantly different position due to the delays.
What's the legal standard as far as how convincingly prejudice must be established?
That's a good question. I think that there's cases that list or that use different language, and I'm not sure that that I can conclusively state what the best way is to frame that. The case law is clear that there's the three different types that that courts look at in terms of oppressive pretrial incarceration, that heightened rather than ordinary anxiety and the impaired defense, and that's the most important piece is the impaired defense. But I don't know that I mean, mostly the cases look and see that there's no prejudice, and other than when witnesses, you know, have been lost or there's such an amount of time.
But the defendant doesn't have to show certainly that there was prejudice.
I think that we need more of a showing than we have here, where I think it's way too far afield from any sort of. I don't think that the court could say that that he was likely prejudiced, is what I can say. We haven't even reached sort of that bar.
But you're not. You don't have a position as to what that bar is as a matter of law, how we define it.
I guess I don't. I'm not clear on that. I apologize. Here, however,
the burden is on appellant to demonstrate prejudice.
Correct.
That is clear in the case law.
That is clear, and here I think that that the showing is far lower than what we can rely on to say that there would be prejudice in a case like this.
What about the argument about the anxiety that that appellant experienced as a result of, you know, understandably here the case, you know, from his perspective, the case is dismissed, and then all of a sudden he's being recharged after this other case is, you know, after the decision in another case is reversed on appeal. You know, it seems like that's a would cause someone anxiety. Was there a showing of sufficient showing in that regard?
I would say two things. The first is that State versus Taylor talks about how oppressive pretrial incarceration and heightened rather than ordinary levels of anxiety are not applicable when an appellant is already in custody for another offense. And so for the vast majority of the time frame that we're looking at, appellant was in custody on the domestic assault case. In particular, the longest period of time, which is when the Danko case was dismissed, and between the dismissal and the refiling, which is close to a year, that entire time there wouldn't be any anxiety about this case because that case was dismissed and the state had no intention of refiling that case. So I would say my first answer is that that heightened rather than ordinary level of anxiety doesn't apply to the vast majority of this time period because he was in custody on another case.
It would apply from October to January. October 2018 to January 2019.
I would say arguably it would, although when the domestic assault case was reversed, he was held on that case. So he was being held on both cases, and so even if he'd been released on the Danko case, he was being held on the domestic abuse case. I would say secondarily that that it is understandable that there would be some anxiety when a case has a more complicated legal posture, but that really would only come into play if the court was considering that sort of level of anxiety as Your Honor just stated, the time frame in the fall of 2018.
So looking at giving up the possibility of concurrent sentences as a type of prejudice, was there a plea deal in this case? Is that in the record about dismissing the domestic assault case?
So do you mean in January when this ultimately resolved?
Yes.
It was not a plea agreement. There was an agreement as to proceeding to a stipulated facts trial for a sentence, if found guilty, of 30 months. But the dismissal of the domestic assault was not a part of that negotiation as it appears on the record.
And was it dismissed with prejudice, or could it be refiled?
The domestic assault case?
Yes.
It was dismissed on the record, and it was not dismissed with prejudice. It was the state of its own initiative dismissed the domestic assault case.
But prior to refiling the Danko charges, there were some discussions between the state and appellant regarding resolving the domestic assault case and tying that to the Danko case, correct?
There was absolutely efforts to resolve. So when the case was reversed on appeal, the state attempted to resolve the domestic case. Obviously, the domestic assault case was a case that went to trial. The victim came in and testified, and so the state would certainly have an interest in resolving that case after the reversal. So I know that an offer was made. I would have to review the record more closely to see when the state put on the record that it was contemplating refiling the Danko case. I know that an offer was made, I believe, for 47 months on the domestic assault case at one point after that case came back from being reversed. So I know that an offer was made. Ultimately, obviously, the state decided to refile the Danko case to sort of restore it to the original position prior to going to trial on the domestic assault, which was ultimately reversed. And ultimately, the sentence that appellant has received after the stipulated facts trial was a sentence of 30 months. And importantly, he received credit back to the date of when that offense occurred, which means that the entire period of incarceration on the domestic abuse case that was later reversed was something that he got credit for all of that time, and so he wasn't in a worse position sentencing-wise.
He's not serving additional time.
Correct, right. And so he was released from prison on the Danko case, I believe it was back in November of last year.
Okay, thank you. The state in its brief and here at oral argument argues that, appellant, excuse me, I have a bit of a virus, so I might misspoke there. But anyway, the appellant argues that the state engaged in legal maneuvering and therefore we shouldn't toll the time between the initial filing or the dismissal of the initial charges and the refiling of the charges. And you heard appellant's argument here today about legal maneuvering. Can you respond to that?
Yes. The state's position is simply that the record does not support an inference that this is the kind of legal maneuvering that's disfavored by the Casper case. I think that when...
Did the state engage in legal maneuvering?
No, I don't believe, as we're using that phrase, I don't believe that the state did. I think that this is a case where, when looking at the record globally, after the domestic assault trial at the sentencing hearing, the state advocated, I believe, for a sentence of 48 months. The court sentenced him to 60 months. And so clearly taking into account that the state received or obtained a sentence that was even lengthier than the state was advocating for after trial, that the state considered judicial economy. Also, is it fair and just? Should the state be obtaining more convictions on a defendant who's already been sent to prison? I would argue that that's showing fairly good faith by the state, being reasonable, dismissing a case when there's really no reason to pursue it, either for public safety or for the victim. And so I would argue that at that juncture, the state is acting in good faith, and that it's clear when looking at the record as a whole in context that the state had no intention at the time of dismissal of refiling. Some of the cases that we see that sort of cue up this particular posture, the state is dismissing with the intention of refiling as soon as they are able to, given whatever the parameters are of a particular case. In this case, the state clearly was dismissing that case with no intention of refiling. The refiling only occurred when the domestic assault conviction was reversed and the state found itself in a different position, and that it is akin to a plea negotiation in that the state had two serious felony cases against this appellant, and that the state had dismissed one because of obtaining a prison sentence and wanted to restore the state to its original position in terms of obtaining the right result for public safety.
I have a question for you about the counting of the time. You argue that in your brief that for purposes of determining the time, we should consider appellant's speedy trial demand made on October 5th, 2017, rather than October 21, 2017, when he first made the request, and you argue that based on the rules of criminal procedure. But in State v. Jones, the Supreme Court said that the delay in speedy trial cases is calculated from the point at which the Sixth Amendment right attaches when a formal indictment or information is issued against a person or when a person is arrested and held to answer for a criminal charge. So how is your position consistent with State v. Jones?
Yeah, I would be happy to clarify. The right to a speedy trial is undoubtedly constitutional, and it does attach when the Sixth Amendment attaches. And so in Minnesota, there's also a rule-based framework, and so these are essentially two parallel running frameworks. And so although the constitutional right attaches with the Sixth Amendment, what the rule's importance, the constitutional right to a speedy trial doesn't specify a number of days that is a presumptive violation of the right. There's not a number of days that triggers it. However, under the rule framework, that is where we find the 60-day triggering language that triggers analysis of the further factors. So essentially, the state's position is that if we're determining the amount of the 60 days for the purposes under the first factor of triggering the remaining analysis, then we need to follow the construct of the rule, because the 60-day triggering framework is a rule-based framework. And so naturally, yes, the right does attach with the Sixth Amendment and attaches earlier. But for the purposes of computing, did we reach that 60-day mark that triggers further analysis? Then we need to be looking at the rule framework. Here,
well, that makes sense, but in looking at the reasons for the delay, you're also focused on the rules, not the Sixth Amendment speedy trial trigger. And so I'm wondering about that. Because that's where it really, I mean, both parties agree that we're over the 60 days here. So
So I think that, and so since we're triggered into the rest of the analysis, we should look at the entire time frame. And some we do look at those first 45 days when assessing as a whole, as part of the balancing factors. But I think, you know, even then, there's a 45-day period between the first demand and October 5th, which is when the other demand was made, and then an additional 39 days. And so that first period of time is not particularly lengthy. It is a little bit beyond the 60, but that's not looking at that framework. I think that in the state's view, we would not count under CASPER the time between the dismissal and refile. And so on the whole, since the appellant was not prejudiced, the state would ask that this court affirm.
Okay, thank you. Any rebuttal by appellant?
I realize I'm short on time, so I'll be going speedy Gonzalez here. Okay, the first thing that I'd like to address is whether or not the state engaged in legal maneuvering. And frankly, there can be no doubt that the state engaged in legal maneuvering. It is very clear that when one looks at the entire arc of this case, the entire and do not stop at the dismissal of the Danko violations, it is clear that the state was engaged in legal maneuvering here. And I would leave you with this thought on this point.
Bad faith maneuvering or just legal maneuvering?
The case law uses those terms interchangeably of legal maneuvering and bad faith. I prefer legal maneuvering. I think that this court can describe it as bad faith. I'll tell you what the triggering mechanism, I think, or the trigger point for the use of the term legal maneuvering or bad faith is, and that is the point where the state tries to resolve the domestic assault case that it has been reversed on. Prosecutor approaches Mr. McKell, makes a plea offer that would involve a resolution of the domestic assault and the Danko violations, and also makes it clear to Mr. McKell, if you reject this offer, we are recharging you with the Danko violations. And that is exactly what happened.
So should we only start counting the time from that forward if that's the bad faith?
No.
Or improper legal maneuvering?
No, Your Honor, because the speedy trial demand was made as soon as Mr. Michael was in court. That speedy trial demand was made August 21st. And he made that demand repeatedly. He submitted a UMDDA. The state only decided to not pursue the Danko violations after it had something already that it could hold on to, and that was the domestic assault conviction. And that was when the state said, well, we won't prosecute. But there should not be a yes. Is it Is it an acknowledgement of scarce resources? Yes, it can be described that way. But it's also strategic. It's also legal maneuvering by the state.
Well, because at the they thought
at that point that Mr. Michael would be in prison for 60 months, and it didn't work out that way. That doesn't mean that Mr. Michael loses his opportunity, which he asserted insistently, to resolve the Danko violations. And so the state's conduct after the Danko violations are dismissed and after the domestic assault is reversed, that's very critical. That's a very critical time period and critical events. I'm going to move on to the next point, which is this court doesn't necessarily seem persuaded that Mr. Michael was prejudiced. We disagree. Mr. Michael was prejudiced. But even if this court finds that Mr. Michael was not prejudiced, Mr. Michael has met the other three Barker factors. This is a balancing test. These four factors are a balancing test. Plus, we have legal maneuvering by the state. So when all of those circumstances and facts are considered, Mr. Michael's right to a speedy trial was violated, and his right to speedy disposition of the Danko violation under the UMDDA also was violated. So we would urge this court to reach that conclusion.
With regard to the UMDDA, is there any case law that supports your view that that time continues from when he was initially charged through when he was recharged and then convicted as opposed to restarts when he's recharged?
Yes, Your Honor. I would refer the court to State versus Miller. It's a 1994 case that specifically addresses a UMDDA violation. It supports Mr. Michael's argument that his rights under the UMDDA were violated and that the violation warrants reversal. The court concluded in Miller that the state dismissed the charges against the defendant to avoid the six-month time limit and also noted, and this is important for Mr. Michael's case, that the UMDDA exists for the purpose of establishing and protecting a prisoner's right to the speedy disposition of untried charges. And so to not find a violation of the UMDDA here really permits the state to work around the very clear and straightforward language of the UMDDA statute, which is... I'm out of time. Thank you.
That was very helpful. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefs. The arguments were very helpful, and we will carefully consider the issues and issue our opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you.